Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we're going to have a very, very special evening, and we're going to have Dave Emery back with us again. And, of course, those of you who don't know it, Dave, many, many years ago here in the Monterey Bay area, there was a woman named Mae Brussels, and Mae did talk radio. I can remember talking to Mae probably 35, close to 40 years ago. And she, of course, did a great deal of research trying to tie together all the various parts of what's going on today. And Mae would get on to the radio, and she would talk for an hour, giving the various things that were going on and all the interconnections between them. Fascinating to listen to her. But when she passed away, why, Dave Emery got many of her records and picked this up. I find that Dave's discourse, in many respects, is much easier to follow. Mae sometimes would jump from subject to subject to subject. Our guest this evening, Dave Emery, really he'll get on a subject, he'll develop the subject in a calm, collected, organized manner. And it's always a pleasure to have Dave Emery on the program with us. Good evening, Dave. How are you?
It's a pleasure, Dr. Stan. I'm doing just fine. I'm recovering from surgery, so just kind of easing back into the routine. And my encounter with our applied public health care system was very interesting indeed. We'll get diverted off onto that subject, something I'm sure as a physician that you could go on at great length about, but I'm doing fine, Dr. Stan. How you doing?
I'm doing just great. But good. First, you know, I remember what happened to Joe McCarthy. I talked to the doctor who did the physical exam on Joe McCarthy when he went into Bethesda just for a routine workup. And he was quite healthy, but a week later he was very dead. And, of course, James Forrestal went in Bethesda, and he just happened to jump out of one of the windows there. We know what happened to Jim Keith. I don't know if you know Jim Keith, but he wrote books for the Illuminati Press, great books, great researcher. He went in for a very, very simple knee operation, and, well, he died of a pulmonary embolus very shortly thereafter. Now, I've done probably several thousand arthroscopic operations on a knee. I can never think of anybody who ever died. In fact, I can't even think of anybody that ever got a phlebitis or a pulmonary embolus, much less die from a pulmonary embolus. But Jim Keith did, and then, well, maybe it was just a coincidence that within 2 months, why, his publisher died, and then a couple of months later, his ex-wife died. Anyway, I'm glad to know that you're doing well.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll see. I, of course, when you go in for surgery, I mean, you're unconscious, you're vulnerable, but it was one of those things. I deferred it for a long time, and it was for a hernia, a double hernia, actually, but I'm an old blue-collar worker, and, you know, as one rounds in middle age. By the way, I also celebrated my 55th birthday recently.
Well, so. Congratulations. You're just 20 years younger than I am.
So, you know, those things happen, though. I mean, if you spend your life, at least, you know, my regular working life, lifting things and so forth, sooner or later, you know, the foundations give way. But, I was scared. I was really frightened going into that for the reasons that you cited. And I realized, well, you know, I got to have this done. And so it was kind of like the flyers. And, oh, let's see, 1 second.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dave Emery. And Dave, are you back?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm just in the lobby of one of the stations at which I work because I aired my own program, my own pre-recorded program from 6 to 7, so I'm pulling double duty. But as I was saying, Dr. Stan, I just, and I think maybe this is, you know, something of a jumping off point in terms of the attitude that I think people in this country have to take if they're going to survive, if the country's going to survive. I hearken back to the flyers in World War II, you know, when they were going on bombing runs, you know, they had to hold formation and the enemy, whether Japanese or Germans, would throw up a huge wall of flak, you know, in the area that they knew the planes were going to be coming through. And the flyers just had to hold formation and hope they didn't get hit, but they couldn't spend time worrying about it. So I kind of took that same attitude going into the surgery. Yeah. Yeah,
of course, I have the attitude that I put my hands and my life in the hands of God. I figure He has guided me to where I am today, and if He wants me to continue, I'm going to continue, and if He doesn't, why, I'm not going to. And, you know, we know this was the attitude of people like General Patton and General MacArthur. I'm not putting myself into that category, but it's often told of how all the other officers would be cowering under a table if there was an aircraft raid, and there would be General MacArthur sitting at the table saying, "It's not my day. I'm not going to get under the table." So I really think sometimes we have to take that attitude, because you and I are on the front lines of a really vicious battle, a battle for the survival of Western civilization. And although we may differ theologically, while we see the common enemy, and I think we have to just be there, we have to stand up, and sometimes we're exposed, sometimes we're vulnerable, but at least we've been given the unique opportunity to have a voice and to begin reaching people all across America. And I think there is an increasing awareness on the part of many people, not as many as I wish there were, but that recent Zogby poll in New York, pointing out that in New York, and I assume it was New York City, 50% of the people do not believe the government story of what happened on 9-1-1. The fact that poll, I think, is a very legitimate poll. Zogby is very, very reliable. I think one of the most reliable pollers we have. I think that shows that more and more people are beginning to think.
Yeah, they certainly are, and I second your conviction that this is not only is the work essential, but one must at a certain point, I think, rely on faith in terms of protection. I guess one could say, extending, you know, the aerial warfare metaphor from World War II, God is our co-pilot. You know, that famous was it a novel or a movie or both? I believe.
No, I saw it. It was a book, but I think it became a movie. We'll be back in just a moment here with Dave Emery. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Dave, I understand you wanted to talk this evening about the upcoming elections. Is that what you'd like to deal with?
Well, one aspect of them, you know, I'm open to whatever you'd like to kick around.
Well, let's go ahead and take off. Let's talk about the elections from your point of view, and then I'll put in my thoughts. And then, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, well, I would love to hear from you as well. Our telephone number, as you know, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. But please hold your calls at least until the half hour, because we want to sort of develop these ideas, and then we'll take calls after the half hour. Let's go ahead and get your thoughts. We have two candidates. Both of them seem to be dedicated to globalism. Both of them seem to be dedicated to open borders. Both of them seem to be dedicated to ever larger government. And they talk about cutting taxes, but how can you cutting taxes when you're increasing spending? Both of them are dedicated to the war, continuing the war in Iraq for some reason. I haven't quite figured out. Well, I know why, but so now, you know, if you look at and see what's really going on, I don't think there's a great deal of difference. Of course, they've convinced a lot of Christians that the Republicans are pro-life, anti-abortion, and yet, however you feel about the abortion issue, I would simply point out that the recent bill that was passed in Washington, D.C., and signed by the president that outlawed partial birth abortion was the worst disaster that we've ever seen from the conservative Christian point of view, because what the bill did, and the tragedy is most Christians have never read the bill. It's signed into law what the Supreme Court had done without any justification, and that was Roe versus Wade. The Congress and the Senate voted, and the President signed a bill that codified into law Roe versus Wade. And isn't it amazing that none of the Christians in America even know it was in that legislation? And everybody stood up and applauded, and now we've outlawed partial birth abortion, and the courts promptly struck that part of the legislation down, but they're going to let the part stand where Congress and the President now support abortion on demand. So pick up the story there.
I should stress that I'm not a Christian, although I certainly have, I can't think of anything that I've ever seen attributed to Jesus that I didn't agree with. I refer to myself as a non-denominational believer, because I definitely believe in the existence of a higher power, and in fact, it is the motivation for doing what I'm doing. I've just completed my 25th year on the air, Dr. Stan. I'm beginning my second quarter of a century. And initially, what got me started was examining the assassination of President Kennedy. And I went on from there. I mean, the official version of the Kennedy assassination is readily verifiable nonsense. And in particular, I noted that Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, and he flew out about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours before President Kennedy was assassinated. But when the Warren Commission interviewed him, in February of 1964, he said the only time he was in Dallas, Texas, was in 1963, was 2 days prior to the assassination. Whereas the San Francisco Chronicle, the New York Times, among other papers, carried a UPI story, Dateline Dallas, Texas, in their November 22nd edition. And there was an interview with Richard Nixon in Dallas, Texas, on November 21st, 1963, a day after he claims he left, and he's talking about how he would do everything possible to see to it that President Kennedy would not be reelected.
He wasn't reelected, that's for certain.
No, definitely not. And it's interesting because there's been a lot of there have been quite a few retrospectives about Nixon recently. I don't know exactly why, although the 30th anniversary of his resignation took place last August. But obviously, when he told the Warren Commission that he had left Dallas, the only time he was in Dallas, Texas, was on November 20th, 1963. Obviously, was misrepresenting things. That would be grounds to convict him of perjury, and from a legal standpoint, since he obviously was lying in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy, it would have been grounds to indict him for the actual murder. When one examines the Watergate case, and Nixon was deliberately ousted because he'd run afoul of a number of different people, and institutions, in particular, his plan to centralize all intelligence functions had alienated the CIA. He wanted to have one giant super intelligence agency, and that was to be realized under something called the Houston Plan, named after Tom Charles Houston. He had alienated the CIA. In that regard, the CIA helped to get rid of him. He also had angered the American far right. His rapprochement with China, among other things, was loathed by the far right in this country. They wanted to get rid of him. And interestingly enough, in his book The Ends of Power by former Nixon White House aide H.R. Bob Haldeman, he states that what Nixon was worried about with regard to the Watergate tapes, which ultimately led to his ouster, was that if the tapes were released, it would reveal, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote. And in his book, The Ends of Power, Bob Haldeman states that in the Nixon White House, that was a code word for the Kennedy assassination. So I got my start there and proceeded on, here we are. My initial motivation was patriotism. When I realized that the President of the United States, and a man, by the way, whom I very much admired, I was very young, but I had a very high regard for President Kennedy, and indeed, he's a man whose legacy has been so sullied. People really don't know the things that he was trying to do. He was trying to get us out of Vietnam. He concluded that that was a disaster that was going no place. He and Nikita Khrushchev, who was a veteran of World War II, had both concluded that the Cold War had to end, that if it continued, it was very likely to result, if not in nuclear war, certainly in the decimation of both societies. And there were a lot of things that he was doing that would have been admirable. He had sworn to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces in his second term. He had he was trying to eliminate the oil depletion allowance, which is a major, major tax ripoff for the big oil companies. But alas, it was not to happen. And so when I first got started, it was out of patriotism and civic spirit. And then over the years, I became very despondent about this country and my hopes for it. So I figured, well, this is for the human race. And in my later years, I've been doing this out of religious conviction. I've certainly taken a different path than most people, and maybe this will seem foolish to some, but I have a strong inner presentiment that basically I'm doing the work of the Creator, that for whatever reason, I'm one of those people who's never quite fit into any particular group. And that's been a source of some loneliness and some pain. But over the years, I've concluded that, you know, there's something. I don't belong to any particular religious denomination, and my concept of the Creator and of the spiritual realm doesn't dovetail precisely with any body of spiritual knowledge that I've encountered. But I'm convinced that there is a higher power. You could call it God, you could call it Buddha, whatever. But it is the prime mover of the universe.
Well, you've come part of the way, then it's only a matter, perhaps, that we'll just keep talking to you, and through the years, maybe we can bring you the rest of the way. But it doesn't really matter. You are certainly very provocative. The information you have is really very, very stimulating, and I know many of our listeners really enjoy your discussions of the various issues.
Well, you know, one of the things that had sort of frustrated me with regard to so much of organized religion is that if a person lives a righteous life and a self-sacrificing life, and I've done that, I don't charge for my work. I've never been good at business, but I never viewed this as a way to earn a living. This was a deep, deep conviction. This is what had to be done. This was my duty as a citizen initially of the United States and then of the planet Earth and the human race, and now of the cosmos. And I do believe that I'm doing the work of the Creator. But it's one of the things that's frustrated me with regard to so much of organized religion. If a person lives a righteous life and a brave life and a selfless life and sacrifices him or herself for the good of humanity, for the common good, how could that person be denied a place in eternity after their death simply because they didn't follow one or another particular religious ritual, whereas somebody could do that and be a wicked person, you know, and how could that do it? But anyway.
Well, that, of course, gets to whether or not you accept the Bible as the Word of God, and, of course, we don't want to get into a theological discussion. I happen to accept the Bible as the Word of God, and, of course, the message of the Bible is, it is because of your belief in the Savior that you will have salvation. Nothing that you could do or I could do would anyway, of course, make up for the fact that we are basically sinful men, but, of course, there is an opportunity for all of us to obtain salvation, no matter how bad we are. But let's get back to some of those things. Of course, you were very concerned about what happened to President Kennedy. I'm sure you were concerned then when his brother was killed, when Martin Luther King was killed. And we had a whole spat of very, very strange deaths. In fact, every one of them had the hallmarks, the earmarks of the CIA in those assassinations. Anybody who studied the strange death of President Kennedy, where, of course, Saran Saran is standing in front of Bobby Kennedy firing, whereas the shots enter the back of his body. And then, of course, with Martin Luther King, why there's no question, and I think anybody's ever studied what happened at that time, that James Earl Ray was not the assassin, that he was the patsy, just like Lee Harvey Oswald was the patsy for what happened. And in some respects, as Timothy McVeigh was the patsy for what happened in Oklahoma City, although I think that Timothy McVeigh really was involved in that, whereas I don't think either Oswald or James Earl Ray were involved. But Timothy McVeigh was certainly part of something much larger than the American people have been told.
And Saran, by the way, could not have killed Robert Kennedy. The fatal shot was fired from a distance of less than 3 inches from the back of Robert Kennedy's head, and Eyewitnesses have placed Saran anywhere from 3 to 12 feet in front of President Kennedy.
Well, so maybe it was one of those magic bullets that just sort of whizzed around. And anyway, I mean, if anybody's really studied these things, they know we've been lied to. Just as we're being lied to about so much of what's going on today, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dave Emery, and I think we're going to hopefully get back to what's happening with the elections. And we have two candidates, both come from the same secret society, both of them have basically the same policy. We call it Socialist Party R, Socialist Party D. Which one do you want to vote for? We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest this evening is Dave Emery. Why don't you pick up the story from there?
Okay. And by the way, I agree with you about Tim McVeigh. My own feeling about McVeigh was that he was party to the conspiracy, but he willingly sacrificed himself to allow a lot of other people to escape, and I think he wanted to die. I think he was a true believer. He believed in his cause, and but I think he was out there deliberately to sort of offer himself up as a kind of a sacrificial lamb and a very obvious suspect to be arrested. But back to the elections. One of the things that I think is in a way, it's representative of what started me on the road that I'm traveling now, and that is reading things that I thought were very important in the newspapers and books and magazines. Initially, it was the daily papers. There's amazing things that come out in the daily press, even though our media are badly censored. For example, The Wall Street Journal of April 18th, 2002, contained an amazing story. It was on page A4. It was authored by Glenn R. Simpson, and I've forgotten his co-author's name. I believe his last name was Turow, T-H-U-R-O-W. In any event, on March 20th of 2002, the largest terrorist funding largest terrorist funding bust in history had taken place. And it was aimed at interdicting the funding's conduits for Al-Qaeda, for Hamas, for Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Where do you suppose that bust took place, Dr. Stan?
Well, you're going to have to tell me because I don't remember the article.
Well, there have been a number of stories about it. It didn't take place in Damascus, Syria. It didn't take place in Saudi Arabia. It didn't take place in Iraq. It didn't take place in Malaysia or the Philippines. It took place in suburban Washington, D.C., It took place in Maryland and primarily in Virginia, in the Beltway area around Washington, D.C. Customs Department agents, then working for the Treasury Department along with a coterie of FBI personnel, raided a number of overlapping Islamic charities and businesses, organizations that shared, in many cases, addresses or were right across the road from one another. They had overlapping personnel, overlapping financial resources, and it was part of what I call a milieu. And they arrested them for funding terrorism, including and especially Al-Qaeda. There's a very strong area of intersection between these individuals and institutions, and an institution called the Islamic Institute, which is actually, for all intents and purposes, a branch of the Republican Party's ethnic outreach. This was put together by one of the most powerful conservative lobbyists in Washington, D.C., a guy named Grover Norquist.
Yes, I know Grover personally. Go ahead.
Really?
Yes.
Well, he put together, came up with the idea sometime in the late 90s that with a growing Muslim population in the United States, and with many of those Muslims sharing very, very conservative views, or at least some areas of political opinion that dovetailed with the Republican Party, that they might be able to form an alliance. Norquist was very impressed with the performance of the Afghan Mujahideen in defeating the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and plus many of the conservative Muslims held views similar to the GOP on things like abortion, birth control, women's rights, and other social issues. And they didn't like democracy, frankly, and they believed in the institutionalization of the privileges of a great wealth. So Norquist saw this as a fit, a wonderful fit with the GOP. He also...
Hold that thought for just a moment, Dave. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Dave Emery. We're talking about the funding of the Islamic terrorist movement throughout the world, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Al-Qaeda. And Dave was commenting that back on the 18th of April, 2002, on page A4 of the Wall Street Journal, was an article written by Mr. Glenn Simpson going into a raid that they'd done there, of course, of a number of interlocking organizations, Islamic organizations that were funding the world terrorist movement. And one of these was an organization known as the Islamic Institute that was headed by a man named Grover Norquist, who I happen to personally know. And he is one of the conservative leaders in Washington, D.C., who has been working with the Muslim people. Of course, at one time, they were split almost equally between the Republicans and Democrats. I might quote, the latest Zogby poll within the last week has shown that 76% of the Muslims in America are going to vote for Kerry, 7% are going to vote for Bush. That's certainly not a very successful position for Grover Norquist, who has been, of course, pushing to bring the Muslims into the Republican Party. But pick up the story there.
Yeah, American Muslim population, it's anything but homogeneous, too, because there are some Muslims who've moved here from countries that are primarily Muslim, and they came here to get away from that social system. Then there are also many African Americans who have converted to Islam. And so it's anything but a homogeneous population. And the Norquist effort appears to have been relatively successful for the year 2000, when it appears that much of the Muslim vote did in fact go to George Bush. What eventually came out, though, was that some of these Muslims who were allied with the Islamic Institute were in fact terrorists or people who were running interference for terrorists. In particular, a Norquist protege named Abdurrahman Alamoudi was someone who was very closely associated with the American Muslim Council. Appears to have been involved with a number of institutions that overlap Al-Qaeda, including the Bank Al-Taqwa. And I'll follow your lead, Dr. Stan. I know we've spoken about Bank Al-Taqwa in the past, but...
You'll go right ahead, because I think that people need to be reminded about this network of Islamic banks and organizations, and so many of them are strongly tied into the Saudi royal family, which is strongly tied into the Bush administration, and of course, but really not just the Bush administration, they were tied into the Clinton administration. They play both sides against the middle, and they've of course been manipulating our political system for a number of years, and of course they have tremendous, massive investments of welfare. Close to almost $1 trillion of Saudi money is invested right here in America. Why, if they pull that money out tomorrow, why, the day after tomorrow, our economy would collapse, literally. If you pull that $1 trillion out from all the investments. So certainly our government has been doing everything they could to conceal the Saudi involvement in funding of Al-Qaeda and even in funding of the attack on the World Trade Center, conceal that from the American people. And, of course, now then, of course, the Islamic people were giving Grover Norquist a good deal of money to try to build up the Islamic image here in the United States after 9/11.
Indeed, there were, however, very strong areas of intersection between some of the people involved with Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute and institutions like Al-Qaeda and Hamas. Now, Bank Al-Taqwa is also known as Nahda Management, is an institution that is basically the financial arm of an organization called the Muslim Brotherhood, which, even though it is Islamic, it is a totalitarian Islamic theocratic organization. It's basically an Islamic fascist organization.
It's been around since 1928, originated in Egypt, and it, of course, is the one of the really only two sources before the Afghan War where they were really pushing this idea of returning to this radical form of Islam that calls upon people to die fighting for Allah. This was not a prevalent belief before it began to be actively encouraged by the CIA during the Afghan War.
And in fact, according to John Loftus, who, by the way, is a former career military officer and Justice Department investigator with a very, very high security clearance, the Muslim Brotherhood, and we should maybe just jump back briefly in history, the Muslim Brotherhood, as you quite correctly, one of the things I know with you, Dr. Stan, will always get good factual background support. But yes, it began in 1928, and in order initially to oust the British and French as the colonial masters of the Middle East, and also in order to help to destroy the Soviet Union. We should remember that in the former Soviet Union, many of the southern Soviet republics had largely Muslim populations. Some of the echoes of that we're seeing now in Chechnya. But in order to create what they saw as a desirable state, which is a worldwide Muslim state, they allied themselves with fascist Italy and even more importantly with Nazi Germany.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Arthur Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dave Emery. And, of course, Dave is talking about the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a really key organization in everything that's going on today. In fact, if you go into the background of, for instance, the cell that was in New York City with the blind sheik, Omar Rahman, why, of course, you find that many of the people there were Egyptians. In fact, al-Zuhari, Osama bin Laden's right-hand man, was Egyptian, and the Muslim Brotherhood started out as an Egyptian organization, and as David said so well, there were close ties between this radical form of Islam and Nazi Germany. In fact, the Grand Mufti had actually been in Germany during the Second World War and mobilizing support for Adolf Hitler, and of course, the Grand Mufti, I think it's his nephew, was a man named Arafat. But go ahead, pick up the story.
Yes, indeedy. The Grand Mufti, by the way, was actually held the rank of major in the SS. He recruited three Muslim Waffen-SS divisions from the Balkans, 13th Waffen-SS or Hanjar Division, 21st Waffen-SS or Skanderbeg. By the way, recruited from among the Muslim Albanian Muslim population of Kosovo. And many of the people who eventually became members of the Kosovo Liberation Army were the sons and grandsons of people who had served in the 21st Waffen-SS. Also, the 23rd Waffen-SS, or Kama Division, was also a Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS division recruited by the Grand Mufti. He, by the way, also was very active with the Japanese, because we shouldn't forget that there are large Muslim populations in Asia, in places like Malaysia and the Philippines, both of which were coveted and conquered by the Japanese. In China, of course, in what had been the British colony of India, which embraces what we today know as Pakistan. So he was active there, too. He, by the way, became the first head of the Palestinian National Movement. And he was an SS officer. By the way, interestingly enough, Dr. Stan, I was reading some material about the Grand Mufti. He actually got his start in politics, if one could call it that. For the Grand Mufti, politics means basically slaughtering innocent people. But he actually had been an officer in the Turkish army in World War I and had been very active in the massacre of the Christian Armenian population around Shmira. Among the genocides that has largely been overlooked by the human race is the Turkish massacre of the Armenians in World War I. Some 1.5 million, by most counts, Armenians were massacred by the Turks. And the Grand Mufti, who, although an Arab, was an officer in the Turkish army, the old Ottoman Empire occupied all of the what we today call the Arab countries, he initially got his start as an officer with the Turkish army massacring Armenians around Shmira.
And for our listeners out there, we do have a four-tape set on the other Holocaust, the one we never talk about, the million Armenians who were killed there right after the First World War. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dave Emery, and we're talking about the Grand Mufti, known as the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, but of course he spent a lot of his time living in Nazi Germany and, of course, working with Turkey, and was, as Dave was pointing out, he'd been responsible for a good part of the slaughter of the Armenians. Following the First World War, the Grand Mufti was truly an evil man who saw nothing wrong with Nazism, and of course, today his nephew is is a man named Arafat, who is, of course, is in charge of the PLO. And who is funding the PLO? Well, of course, we know that Saudi is giving them some money, but you'll be pleased, if you're out there in the listening audience, to know that America, the United States, is giving large sums of money and weapons and training to our good friends in the PLO. The people who work for Mr. Arafat, who is the nephew of the Grand Mufti. So pick up the story there, Dave.
And he not only is the nephew of the Grand Mufti, but he's his protege. Arafat also was the protege of Otto Skorzeny, who was one of Hitler's personal favorites. He was an SS colonel. He was the man who led the daring raid that rescued Mussolini. Skorzeny was also, he went to work for the CIA in the post-war period, as did so many Nazis, and he also was one of the primary functionaries of the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground. The Grand Mufti, by the way, was also one of the people deeply involved with the actual establishment of the PLO. It was established in 64. He was not to leave us for another 10 years, unfortunately. But so when one examines the PLO, I often, Dr. Stan, happily, not on your show, but I often have to walk under the cloud of, Dave Emery thinks everybody's a Nazi. You know, he's always talking about Nazi. He thinks everybody's a Nazi, which is stupid. It's actually sort of a rhetorical flourish to avoid looking at what I talk about. I don't think Rodney Dangerfield is a Nazi. I don't think Tiger Woods is a Nazi. But there are quite a few of them around, and one of them was the Grand Mufti. And the PLO is an institution which retains his murderous Nazi stamp to this day.
Just as a side issue, somebody had sent me a video the other night, and we were watching it, and it was a documentary. It was Sam Donaldson basically did the story. It was the story of the Nazis who went into South America, and of course tracing them from Hitler's Germany through the rat line, the help that they got from certain people working in Rome. 60,000, that was the estimate they gave, 60,000 Nazis were helped to escape to South America with the full support of American and British intelligence. And I'm watching this documentary. Obviously, it's been shown on major television in America. I never had seen it before. 60,000 Nazis we helped escape to South America. Sort of makes you all feel warm and fuzzy, doesn't it? And you wonder who really did win the Second World War.
Well, of course, there's a joke that I've mentioned several times on your show, Dr. Stan. There's an old joke that says, it's a good thing we didn't lose World War II, otherwise all of our officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, and everybody would be driving Japanese and German cars. Actually, I would submit that the United States unfortunately lost World War II, not on the battlefield, of course. Our fighting men gave an excellent account of themselves. But actually, from an economic and political standpoint, I think we did lose World War II. But we lost it during the Cold War. When in order to defeat the Soviet Union and also to maintain the post-war multinational corporate order, what the United States did was to see to it that basically all the people that our fighting men had been struggling against in Germany and Japan were put right back into power, because they were anti-communist. You know, they certainly were anti-communist, but they hated America at least as much, and one of the ironies is they actually viewed America as the greater threat. They didn't feel the Soviet Union had a lot of longevity potential, as of course we now know it didn't, but they saw America as enemy number one, and so they went along with us in the Cold War. Yeah, okay, we'll help you fight the communists, but they were all along eyeballing getting rid of numero uno, which is us, and sadly, I'm afraid those chickens are now coming home to roost. But
before we go on, we've got Ed calling in from Aptos. So let's Ed, did you have a quick question?
Yes, Dr. Stan, I hope this isn't too far off the mark. Dave, do you know anything about an author named David Irving? He wrote a book, Hitler's War and also Churchill's War, and what your thoughts are on it, if you do know?
Yes, Irving is basically an apologist for the Third Reich. In fact, he's someone who has basically disputed the existence of the Holocaust, and he's pretty well known as a sympathizer to the post-war Nazi elements. It's a good account of Irving in a book that's sadly out of print. A lot of the really good books go out of print, but there's a book called The New Reich, Violent Extremism in Unified Germany and Beyond, by a guy named Michael Schmidt, who He wrote about the fierce resurgence of neo-Nazism in Germany after reunification and traced it back to some of the events that we're talking about now. There's a good account of Irving there, addressing a group of SS veterans and amusing them with his brand of humor, which I don't think too many listeners to this program would know much about. He's a very intelligent guy and very scholarly too, and that's one of the reasons why I condemn him as thoroughly as I do, because he's way too intelligent, way too worldly wise, and way too well read to actually believe the things he would have us believe. I think he's basically a shill for what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich that went underground and has perpetuated itself in a manner not unlike the Mafia. The Mafia began in 12th and 13th century Sicily as an underground resistance movement against first Norse, basically Viking occupiers, and later Saracens. Well, of course, the Vikings and the Saracens are long gone from Sicily, but the Mafia is still very much there. And they're not just there, they're here, too. Every Sunday night at 9 p.m., a large percentage of American television viewers tune in HBO so they can watch a melodrama, The Sopranos, based on an institution, the Mafia, which began as a resistance movement in Sicily in the 12th and 13th centuries, basically 1,000 years ago, practically. And so that, in some ways, is instructive. The Third Reich has done something very similar, not only by utilizing their tremendous economic power. We should recall that the Nazis were in, they occupied much of Europe for a number of years. They also had the most profound connections to very powerful American industrialists and financiers, including and especially the Bush family, by the way. People like Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles, lawyers with the Sullivan and Cromwell Law Firm, and later respectively CIA Director and Secretary of State under Eisenhower, were deeply involved with helping to arrange some of these corporate connections. My own feeling is that the Third Reich itself was an outgrowth of the phenomenon of globalization. Sometime perhaps on Dr. Stan's show we can take some time and stretch out. But I would cite the modern phenomenon of globalization as having its origin in the World War One and immediately post-World War One period, when a combination of the Webb-Pomeroy Act, a loophole for the Antitrust Act in this country, the antitrust legislation made it illegal to have trusts, basically one company dominating an entire industry, but the Webb-Pomeroy Act was a loophole which made it legal for our robber barons, people like the Dulleses, the Harrimans, or no, not the Dulleses, they were lawyers, but the people like the Harrimans, the Rockefellers, the Mellons, the Morgans, the DuPonts, and the other high rollers, to establish worldwide monopolies with their compatriots in other countries. That and the Treaty of Versailles, which imposed severe economic reparations against German corporations, led German corporations to begin looking abroad to find foreign co-partners so that they could basically escape reparations. They didn't want to be stigmatized as German corporations. Our high rollers, so to speak, were looking abroad to find business partners so they could begin establishing worldwide monopolies and do an end run on the U.S. antitrust legislation. And when combined with a tremendous U.S. economic expansion of the World War One and years in 1920, recall that we didn't get into World War One till 1917, this country made a lot of money, not only lending money to the warring European powers so they could finance the construction of the engines of war with which to carry on the conflict, but also we made a lot of weapons for the warring powers of Europe. And at the end of the war, the United States was the only manufacturing power, major manufacturing power, still intact. The other countries had gone into debt, their industrial labor forces had been slaughtered in the trenches, so we were kind of ruling the roost. And so with that tremendous amount of capital at their disposal, the American robber barons looked abroad and they saw people, including people in Japan and Germany, who figured to be wonderful investment partners, and they began investing with them. They began setting up what are known as cartels, which are international monopolies. So I believe that World War II itself and the military power that Japan and Germany wield as a result of their heavy industrial capacity, which came basically from American lending institutions. And
not only that, but from American corporations. In fact, Professor Sutton's wonderful book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, simply points out that American banks were financing Adolf Hitler, General Motors was over there, Ford Motor Company was over there, DuPont was over there. Certainly Exxon was over there, Rockefeller interest, giving them the ability, patents so they could make their ethyl gasoline, and so they could make rubber. They could not have had a military presence without the ability to have high-octane gasoline for the military planes. We were lending the money to build the planes, giving them the technology to manufacture the high-octane gasoline to fly the planes. The war machine was basically made by the United States. In fact, when I went through Colonel House's papers at Yale University back in 1980, I came across a letter that had been written by the American ambassador to Germany at that time, Ambassador Dodd, and he's writing to Colonel House in 1936, and he's saying, you know, we just got through a major war, and nobody wants another war, so why are American corporations building up the war-making potential of the German government, the German military, when there's no profit to be made? They can't even get any of the money out of the country because of exchange limitations, exchange restrictions. Do the American stockholders back at home know that their corporations are building up Adolf Hitler, or pardon me, the German military, when there's no profit to be made? And of course, I'm sure that Ambassador Dodd was really exasperated by what he saw, because what he didn't realize is that Colonel House was part of this little cabal that rules the world, and of course, deeply involved in the occult. And of course, I believe a real force behind Adolf Hitler and the men who surrounded him was their association with the Thule Society and the World Occult Movement. I believe this is why they were as successful as they were. And of course, I believe the reason that we helped their men, the Nazis, escape to South America, all 60,000 of them, and brought many of them here under Operation Paperclip, was because there were these same occult forces working at the highest echelons of our government as well.
Yes, indeed. One of the things that's always challenging about appearing on your show, Dr. Stan, it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose or trying to drink from a fire hose. You know, it's not that there isn't a lot of water there. It's just a question of whether you'll be able to assimilate it in a fashion that is doable. But, going back to the Muslim Brotherhood and Yousef Nadda.
Okay, let's get back to this whole situation of the Muslim influence, the Muslim fascist influence.
And it actually fits very nicely into the line of discussion that we're having. John Loftus, who's a very heroic, a genuine American hero, he was a military officer, then a Justice Department investigator. He's held every high security clearance there is, including NATO, Cosmic, I mean, you name it, he's held it. And he was placed in charge of the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations. This was a special unit that had been created to hunt down and prosecute Nazi war criminals who had found refuge in the United States. Well, he began doing that. What he found was that all these Nazis he was hunting had come into the country courtesy of the CIA and related institutions. And in particular, there was a program in the early 50s called the Crusade for Freedom, in which many Nazi war criminals and fascist collaborators from allied fascist movements such as the Romanian Iron Guard, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Croatian Ustashi, and others were brought into the United States in order to basically counteract the Jewish vote, which had been traditionally democratic, and also to mobilize the Eastern European ethnic communities, primarily in the American Northeast and Midwest, on behalf of the GOP, and to make them more vehemently anti-communist than they were. And what John Loftus found was that this program, in which actual SS intelligence units were resettled, complete and intact in the United States, the program was the godchild of Alan Dulles, and the person who oversaw this was his protege, Richard Nixon, the fellow who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people into the U.S. was William Casey, at that point director of the CIA, having gone to that position from having been the manager of the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, and the chief spokesperson for the campaign was Ronald Reagan. And this group, this Nazi milieu, actually became a permanent part of the Republican Party, and was made so when the elder George Bush was chairman of the Republican National Committee. So John Loftus left. He did an appearance on 60 Minutes, now, of course, a focal point of a lot of controversy. But as he put it, Mike Wallace, you know, got the Emmy, and my family got the death threats. You know?
Well, John, where did John Loftus write this up?
This is written up in the book, The Secret War Against the Jews.
All right, fine. I just happened to have that in the library, and I haven't read it, so I'm going to have to.
Oh, it's one of the most amazing books. It's amazing.
In fact, really, this documentary, this Sam Donaldson one, why they actually interviewed John Loftus, and he talks about his experience and how they tracked the 60,000 Nazis to South America. And I'd never heard that before. It really became such a revelation. So I knew, of course, about Operation Paperclip, and I knew that large numbers of Nazis had gone to South America. Adolf Eichmann, as you know, and Kurt Klaus Barbie, and Mengele, and, of course, your friend Martin Bormann. But I had no idea they had enough to make major cities down there.
Oh, they did, and then they began, initially Latin America was their place of refuge, but then they began coming to the United States. Because remember, the thing that they had always wanted to do was to destroy the United States. And it's worth remembering, as far from our moorings as we have slid, and we have done that, we are the cradle of democracy. We were the first country to break away from the European monarchies. We inspired the French Revolution. We inspired the Haitian Revolution. And to this day, I mean, as badly abused as America's traditional democratic tradition, thus democratic with a small d, had become, we're still an inspiration to much of the world. And we're also a negative inspiration to the bad guys, because they took a look. I mean, maybe this will seem a little overly simplistic to some people, but they took a look at the United States and said, we have to destroy that.
And I think they're well on their way to accomplishing that at the very present time, which is why I do what I do and why Dave Emery does what he does. People have to understand there are forces working behind the scenes that most people are totally unaware of. And, well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dave to wrap up the program. And, of course, Dave will be with us the next hour. If you're listening up there in the Great Northwest, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com and click on the live streaming and hear the second hour. If you have shortwave, of course, you can get this at either 7.535 or 7.315 megahertz. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, our guest this evening, Dave Emery, and we're talking really about what happened starting here in the United States, where, of course, it was found that there were extensive organizations all interlocked, and they were working, this was back in the year 2002, they were funding this Islamic terrorist movement, Hamas, Hezbollah, and of course Al-Qaeda, and of course this then took us into the background of the Muslim Brotherhood. So we've got about 2.5 minutes to wrap up before this part of this session is over.
All right, well this is going to be challenging. Now, one of the things that we did also, we didn't just bring the European Nazis, we took in the Arab Nazis as well. And again, I cite John Loftus here in a document that I have put on the record. I used it for the record show 473. When the Nazis were ostensibly at least defeated, the British took the whole Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, this was a Nazi intelligence network composed of Islamic Nazis, basically. And they used them, they put the whole Muslim Brotherhood to work against the fledgling state of Israel. Then, after that, the British turned them over to the CIA because they were anti-communist, and the CIA felt that they would be a good counterweight to the growing communist effort in the Arab countries. When Nasser kicked them out, because Nasser was a secular Arab nationalist, the CIA basically, according to Loftus, was responsible for relocating so many of them to Saudi Arabia, including Abdullah Azzam, who became Osama bin Laden's mentor. Then, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, the Muslim Brotherhood was just resurrected. Again, Islamic Arab Nazis were resurrected to fight against the Soviets. They renamed them the MAK, the Maktab al-Qaeda Mat, something Mujahideen, and the elder George Bush was put in charge of supervising these groups. Eventually, the MAK yielded to It yielded al-Qaeda. It morphed into al-Qaeda. Abdullah Azzam, the Muslim Brotherhood mentor of Osama bin Laden, was assassinated. And
I've always thought that Osama bin Laden and the CIA were involved in that assassination. It had killed not only Azzam, but his son.
It may very well be, but the interesting thing is that the Muslim Brotherhood's main financial organ is the bank al-Taqwa. All of al-Qaeda's monies after September 11th, some 20 million that could be traced, were in Bank al-Taqwa.
You know, we're gonna have to pick this up after when we get into the next hour. But it's fascinating. We begin to see all of these interconnections, and of course, when Abdullah Azzam is killed, that puts certainly Osama bin Laden in as the leader of al-Qaeda, really the leader of this whole world Islamic terrorist movement. And of course, isn't it very, very convenient? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And if you'd like to know more about our organization, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Why, we'd love to have you join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Now, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And you can learn more about our ministry. You can certainly learn the various frequencies. Our shortwave is on. You can listen to our internet programs 5 hours a day. Of course, you won't get much of anything accomplished, but you can listen 5 hours a day. Of course, it starts at 7 o'clock in the morning Pacific time, goes to 10 o'clock in the evening Pacific time, and we're on the American Freedom Network, the Genesis Network, at the Radio Liberty Network, and of course, now more recently, we're on the Republic Network, and we're also on the Soundwave Network, and this program is being put up on satellites, so the evening program is actually on three different satellites. What a unique opportunity to get this message out across America, and we do hope that many of you out there will want to join with us, because the big problem we have today, how do you get to people with the truth? How many Americans have ever heard about Operation Paperclip? How many Americans have heard that the American CIA and the British intelligence helped the Nazis escape to South America, when many of them lived out their miserable lives? Of course, a couple of them were captured. Adolf Eichmann and one other were actually captured and taken back to stand trial. But the others escaped punishment because they were actively protected by our own intelligence agencies. So we have a situation where the FBI may be actually hunting down terrorists, and the CIA is actually protecting exactly the same terrorists. We see the same thing all the time with drug operations in the United States, where the DEA is trying to track down the drug smugglers, and the CIA is protecting the drug smugglers. Doesn't make sense unless you understand that there are two basic forces, one a good and one evil, working within our society. And when you begin to understand this dichotomy, then a lot of things begin making sense. America was founded as a Christian nation, but from the very inception of this nation were the dark, spiritual, and evil forces working here to capture control of our government. I fear that today they're in almost total, complete control, despite the fact the majority of the American people are wonderful people who want freedom. There are other people who have a different agenda, and that agenda is a new world order, a new world economic system, a new world monetary system, and a new world religion. So we hope that many of you, of course, will go to our website, pull down our newsletters, get the information that we have up there that's readily available. And Dave, would you like to put out your website before we let the people from the Northwest go?
Yes, www.spitfirelist.com. That's one word, SPITFIRELIST.com. The CD duplication service that carries all of my material is called Spitfire, named after the World War II British airplane. And there's a massive website, the entire book, Martin Bormann, The Nazi in Exile, is available for download for free. There are links to all kinds of things. I put long written descriptions of all of my shows up there. And people can read about the Bank al-Taqwa. By the way, headed up by Youssef Nada, a former Nazi intelligence agent who helped The Grand Mufti escaped from Germany.
All right, we're going to have
World War II.
All right. Well, now for our listeners, why Dave is going to be speaking at the Loud Nelson's here in the Monterey Bay area at 7 o'clock this Saturday evening. That's he'll be speaking at the Loud Nelson Center Saturday night at 7 p.m. I want to remind our listeners about the meeting we're going to have here, an all-day meeting on the 6th of November. That's a Saturday, and of course it's going to be here at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. We do hope that many of you out there and the listening audience across America will want to come. This is a beautiful, beautiful area to visit. And, of course, you can learn more by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. We also want to mention the Institute of the Constitution being held in Salinas every Saturday, 877-448-5798. That's 877-448-5798. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And our guest this evening, of course, is Dave Emery, and we'll ask that you hold your calls for the time being, because we want Dave to get his message out. Now, Dave Emery is going to be speaking here in the Santa Cruz area at the Loudon Nelson Center this coming Saturday evening at 7 p.m. And if you don't know where the Loudon Nelson Center is, why, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'll give you directions how to get there. But or you can call the station right now at, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or preferably 464-8295, and speak to the producer and get the directions to Loudon Nelson. Now, Dave Emery is a fascinating and challenging and provocative speaker, certainly one of the most eloquent people we have as a guest here on Radio Liberty, and I always enjoy having him, and what a privilege it is to have him as a guest. And for those of you who will be able to get down to the meeting on Saturday evening, I'm sure you'll learn a great deal. What are you going to be talking about, Dave?
Going to be talking about the elections, going to be talking about September 11th, connections between the two paths of inquiry, and also some, you know, updating each. Going to be talking about a number of things, also making some suggestions about some things people can do. So,
all right, fine. So if you have an opportunity, if you live in the Monterey Bay area, of course, this program's heard all across America, and it's heard all across the world due to the miracle of Internet and of shortwave. But if you live in our area, why, of course, we hope many of you will want to go down and hear Dave. But let's pick up the discussion we were having. You were talking about, of course, how this bank, El Tatwa, was being used to fund so much of this radical Muslim movement. And then, of course, where was the bank itself getting its funding?
Well, the bank itself was it was a financial institution, and it appears that they were getting monies from sincere and devout Muslims who were channeling part of the Hawala system. But they were getting money from a lot of people, including Saddam Hussein, who oddly enough was a secular Arab fascist and who was deeply opposed to the Islamists. But politics makes strange bedfellows, and business and finance, particularly clandestine finance, makes for strange bedfellows too. Now, the Bank al-Taqwa, or NADA Management, it's headquartered in Lugano, Switzerland. It was originally incorporated in Liechtenstein, which is a tiny little country in Europe that is noted primarily as a money laundering center. It's basically a tiny little place with nothing in it except a bunch of well-placed individuals who launder money for anybody basically who has enough money to launder. The Bank al-Taqwa was the institution that appears to have been the primary financial repository for al-Qaeda's funds. It was headed up by Youssef Nada, who was a Third Reich intelligence agent. He had been with the Abwehr in World War II. And interestingly enough, according to an Italian intelligence report, Youssef Nada and one of his top Muslim Brotherhood aides, and basically the Bank al-Taqwa is the bank for the Muslim Brotherhood, this Islamic fascist organization allied with the Nazis and the Italians in World War II. The British then used it to try to eliminate Israel and its strangle the fledgling Israel in its grave. It then jumped to the CIA, basically the Muslim Brotherhood was the dominant institution underlying the Afghan Mujahideen. It spawned al-Qaeda. And between 1979 and 1984, Youssef Nada and one of his top Muslim Brotherhood and Bank al-Taqwa aides, a fellow named Ali Galeb Himat, fathered between them five children in the United States of America. Now, how about that? I suspect that they were here basically from 1979 to 1984, probably to fund the Mujahideen.
We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Dave Emery, and of course Dave is pointing out that certainly there's a great deal of evidence that some of these key Arab financiers were here in the United States, but of course what the average American doesn't understand is that the FBI was monitoring everything that was going on. And of course, they couldn't let the American people know this, but our intelligence agencies are not made up of bumbling idiots, although that's the impression they try to give you. We had no idea what was going on, and of course they knew what was going on. And if you doubt that, you need to get the video. It's called Jihad in America. It was put out by Stephen Emerson, actually based upon FBI film footage, and it showed the people, you know, in fact, it was people were actually at the Islamic training camps here in the United States, training with automatic weapons. They were being filmed by the FBI. These were the people who were in the cell in New York City that was responsible for blowing up the World Trade Center, the assassination of Rabbi Kahana, and, of course, for the plan to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge and the Lincoln Tunnel, and I think there were 12 sites they were going to bomb. But all of this, of course, was the FBI knew this. They knew it back in 1989. You'll actually see the film footage the FBI was shooting of these Islamic terrorists who were training in 1989. You'll actually see in 1988 Mr. Azam, who we were talking about during the last hour, giving talks in Oklahoma City, talking about jihad and blood flowing in America and how we had to cut off hands and feet so that Allah would have legs to stand on here in the United States. Oh, the FBI monitored everything. Of course, when this film was released in 1994, it was only shown one time, and then the pressure was brought to bear because they could not let the American people know until just the right time, I think about September 11th, 2001, that we were going to war with the Islamic terrorists, because the United States government and CIA had been funding this whole Islamic terrorist movement, and that's covered. We could go into that at some other time. But there's no question we knew the Islamic people were actually raising funds here in the United States. If you read the American Jihad by Stephen Emerson, why, there was testimony before the Intelligence Committee of the Senate in 1996 to the effect that, of course, they were raising funds here. In fact, the majority of the funding for the Islamic terrorist movement was coming from the United States. The Intelligence Committee knew that, but strangely enough, the American people never knew what came out of that testimony. Pick up the story there, Dave.
Well, none of that, but we should remember, too, that the many of the Middle Eastern countries, chiefly Saudi Arabia, that have strong connections to these Middle Eastern terrorists also
hold that have... hold that thought for just one moment.
Alrighty.
Okay, Dave, go right ahead. And Dave is talking about, of course, the funding of Islamic terrorism. I was saying that certainly much of the funding for the Islamic terrorist movement was coming from the United States. The FBI knew exactly what was going on. They were actually taking films of the Islamic terrorists here, plotting jihad. And anybody who doubts that, we actually carry the film Jihad in America. And let me tell you, it's taken me 3 years to get hold of this video and be able to make it available to our listeners. Jihad in America is one of the most important videos ever shown, and that's why it was suppressed actively here in America, only allowed to be shown one time on television in 1994, and then somebody gave orders the American people are not to know about this Islamic terrorist movement, especially the fact it is being funded and financed and planned right here in the United States. But we do have that video now, and you watch that and understand that long before the attack on September 11th, 2001. In fact, going back to 1988, they knew the Islamic terrorists were planning on an attack on America and raising funds here. So you pick up the story there.
Well, they were indeed. And we should bear in mind, too, that one of the primary areas of operation for the Muslim Brotherhood was Saudi Arabia. And, of course, there are many powerful people in Saudi Arabia who finance terrorism. But, of course, Saudi Arabia also has all of that oil and, as such, is really in a position to dictate to the world economy, including the United States. We just haven't done what we should be doing in terms of developing alternative energy sources because we've got to free ourselves from these, I don't know what you call it, the hems of the robes of the Wahhabis, I guess one could say. But they also, as you correctly noted in our first hour, Dr. Stan, they also, those recycled petrodollars, are a primary element of the American industrial economy because basically they have enough money that if they decided to pull it out, it could collapse our economy. So if you combine the Saudi oil with the Saudi petrodollars invested in the U.S. economy, they are in a position to a large extent to dictate to the U.S. And very early on in the political career of the younger George Bush, they sought to gain influence with George W. Bush, and they began financing his energy companies. His very first energy company, Arbusto Oil, appears to have gotten some capitalization from the Khalid, from the Bin Mahfouz and the Bin Laden families, both very, very powerful families. And we should remember that Osama Bin Laden isn't some strange little Bedouin who is living in a tent in the desert. He, if his name was Osama bin Rockefeller, or Osama bin Mellon, or Osama bin DuPont, or Osama bin Morgan, it would give us a better idea, because he is a member of one of the most powerful, wealthy families in Saudi Arabia. Basically, the company that has the monopoly on construction in Saudi Arabia is the bin Laden construction firm. And so they early on, the Saudis, taking a look at the U.S. political and economic landscapes, they seized on the Bush family as a wonderful vehicle for gaining influence, or expanding, I should say. They already gained influence, but expanding their influence in the United States. And it appears that a portion, relatively small portion, but a portion nonetheless of the very first oil company that Bush got into, Arbusto Energy, was financed, at least in part, by the Bin Laden and Bin Mahfouz firms. That eventually, Arbusto went no place. It sort of morphed with increased capitalization into Spectrum 7. That didn't go any place. And then eventually, Spectrum 7, with a lot of capitalization from the Saudis, became Harkin Energy, another of George Bush's oil companies. And as Craig Unger, in a very good book called House of Bush, House of Saud, points out, quoting, by the way, a guy named James R. Bath, who was the North American business representative for both the Bin Laden and Bin Mahfouz families, and was an early investor in Arbusto Energy. Many believe that he was just basically a cutout for the Bin Laden or Bin Mahfouz families, because people who knew Bath at the time said he didn't have much money of his own. But as James R. Bath noted, he's quoted in the book House of Bush, House of Saud, that basically the Saudis had nothing in terms of economic gain or economic profit to gain from financing Bush's oil companies what would be a very successful strike in the Texas Panhandle or in the various Texas oil fields would be nothing in Saudi Arabia. So they're investing in Bush's either failed or only moderately successful oil companies had nothing to do with making money from the actual drilling. It was to gain political influence, and they did that. Now, one of the guys who was appointed courtesy of the Saudi benefactors of George Bush was a guy named Talat Osman. He became a director of Harkin Energy, became a very close political advisor on Middle Eastern affairs to the elder George Bush. He was a friend to both Georges Bush, was a political contributor to both George Bush's political campaigns, and he gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in the year 2000. Well, he also became a key director of Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute. This was part of the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization. We covered this in the first hour. It was founded by Grover Norquist, one of the most powerful lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and someone who, although he does not actually hold a formal position with the Bush administration, is, by virtue of his role as a primary Washington lobbyist, one of the most powerful people with the Bush administration, or one of the largest spheres of influence with the Bush administration, very close to Karl Rove and to George Bush. And he founded the Islamic Institute to try to channel the Muslim vote to the Republican Party, and they were very successful in doing that in the year 2000. Unfortunately, a lot of the people involved, not all, but a lot of the people involved with the Islamic Institute wore two hats. They weren't just Muslims and conservatives, they were also terrorists, and it turned out that many of these people were involved with Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute, and I don't want to be misunderstood as claiming that they are coterminous, but there are strong areas of overlap between the Islamic Institute of Grover Norquist and Al-Qaeda, the Bank Al-Taqwa that we were speaking about, the Bank of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, which is the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, and also Palestinian Islamic Jihad.
Well, let me just say that I think that Grover Norquist is a dedicated conservative, but I think that you'd never want to, of course, join forces with people simply to exploit them, to bring them into the party, because sometimes you may very well be bringing your enemies into the very party that you're trying to support. I think that, philosophically, I think he's sound, but I think that he's made some terrible, terrible errors in his association with the Muslims and taking money from those organizations to act as sort of a spokesman for the Muslim population here in the United States, that we just all got to get along together, the old Rodney King line. But of course, there's some people you can't get along with. This doesn't mean that the average Muslim can't be a good American. It does mean that there are, within the Muslim community in this country, people who are dedicated to the destruction of this country, and you certainly don't want to get into the tent with them.
Oh, no, most definitely not. Most definitely not. On April 4th of the year 2000, on March 20th, the Customs Department, with some assistance by the FBI, finally raided it. They were acting on documentation that were given them by John Loftus, the heroic Justice Department investigator whom we were speaking about in the first hour. Loftus had, by the way, utilizing some of the research that he got from, among other people, Stephen Emerson, whom you correctly lionized in your discussion about jihad in America. One of the people that John Loftus had been investigating, courtesy of his intelligence contacts, by the way, after he wrote the book Belarus Secret, John Loftus was contacted by a bunch of veteran British, American, Soviet, and Israeli intelligence agents, many of whom were retired, but who wanted to speak with him because there were so many dirty secrets that they felt terrible about, that they'd remained silent. And so basically, they retained him. He's a lawyer, but they only paid him a dollar because they didn't have a lot of money, most of them. But it gave them somebody within the Washington legal establishment whom they could influence or whom they could use as an outlet, and their communications with him were protected by attorney-client privilege. Well, John Loftus was investigating a guy named Sami Al-Arian, a professor of computer science at South Florida University, and as it appears now, one of the principal people in North America for Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a brutal terrorist organization.
Now, he eventually, of course, was arrested and charged for that, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. The investigation is an interesting one. In fact, Sami Al-Arian was videotaped in a fundraiser at a mosque wearing traditional Muslim garb. And he was saying, who wants to contribute $500 to kill a Jew? You know, it's a very, very interesting thing to be saying. But, of course, he claims he was not a terrorist, and his defenders claim he's not a terrorist. He eventually became part of this Muslim Republican contingent. He hooked up with George Bush, was actually photographed with George Bush and his family, and boasted of having helped to throw Florida into the Republican camp by convincing many Muslims in Florida to vote for the GOP. Well, the investor, Sami Al-Arian, was one of the people who was getting a lot of money from what became known as the SAAR Foundation, that's S-A-A-R, an acronym standing for Suleiman al-Araji, one of the most powerful Saudi families, and also one of the families involved with financing the Muslim Brotherhood. Anyway, in the Washington, D.C. Beltway area, there was a group of businesses and Islamic charities that were located, in some cases, at the same address, in some cases, right next door to each other or across the street. They had overlapping, they had what are known in business as interlocking directorates, overlapping financial operations, and they heavily overlapped Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute. But it turned out they were financing terrorism, and when John Loftus investigated Sami Al-Arian, he came upon the Safa Group, the SAAR Foundation, and when he submitted his documentation to the Justice Department and the Department of Treasury, they said, we've got to move, and that resulted in that arrest. I'll tell you what happened after that arrest, after this break.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Dave Emery, and we're going into the background, of course, of this raid. We started out the last hour talking about this raid that was described in the Wall Street Journal. It was back in April of the year 2002, and of course they really covered this whole network of organizations that were funding the Al-Qaeda movement, the Islamic terrorist movement, Hamas, Hezbollah, and of course then this all ties into work investigations done by John Loftus, and so this leads to this massive raid and beginning to untangle this whole maze of interlocking Muslim organizations here in the United States, funding terrorism, and of course then linked to Grover Norquist, who is certainly taking money from Muslim organizations. It's sort of a PR firm within the Republican Party for the Muslim movement. The trouble is that the Muslims are not going to support the Republicans. In the latest poll within the last week shows 76% of the Muslims are going to vote for John Kerry. 7% are going to vote for George Bush. Grover Norquist isn't doing a very good job, is he?
Well, I think that Norquist, he did a good job in terms of the Muslim vote was solidly, to all appearances, for George Bush in 2000. But I guess those Muslims learned what a lot of people have learned, basically, you know, welcome to the USA, and they got double-crossed. Well, actually, I wouldn't say they were double-crossed, but it's difficult to generalize because many of the Muslims were sincere, you know, patriots, albeit maybe very conservative, someone that would have differing views from a lot of people, probably not your audience, but they weren't terrorists. But many of them were also terrorists, and so in a sense, when the cover was ripped off of many of the elements that were associated with Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute, it revealed that in fact Norquist and others had been working with and were supportive of elements that were mortally opposed to the United States. This is all what is known as blowback. I mean, in order to prosecute the Cold War, we've allied ourselves, as Alan Dulles put it, and I'm not sure if this, I'll just amend it. I don't want to use language that would be offensive to your audience. But when Alan Dulles was being queried by some of his intelligence associates about all these virulent Nazis that we were putting to work, and also organized crime syndicates, drug dealers, anybody. Basically, what Alan Dulles said was, he said, any expletive deleted, and he used a term that might be offensive to some members of your audience, Dr. Stan, any expletive deleted as long as he's anti-communist. Well, I'm afraid that may turn out to be America's epitaph, because we took in people who were sure enough anti-communist, but they also hated America. In fact, many of these fascists and Nazis from World War II thought America was the greater threat. So it became like a Trojan horse, and we took in these Nazis from Project Paperclip, associated with the Reinhard-Gehlen spy outfit. We basically grafted all of Hitler's Eastern Front intelligence outfit onto the CIA, and then trusted them to tell us the truth about the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And I certainly don't hold a brief for the former Soviet system, but they were nowhere near the threat that we were told they were. In fact, they were a basket case, but a basket case with nuclear weapons, but a basket case nonetheless. But the Nazis were able to convince us that we had to do all of these things, which in the long run were not in our best interest. And that may prove to be the obituary for the U.S. The dalliance between the CIA, and it's really more than that, and what ultimately morphed into Al-Qaeda, the old Muslim Brotherhood, had these same origins. And the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic Arabic Nazi group...
Hold that thought just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Dave Emery. And, of course, would you like to give your website just one more time there?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
www.spitfirelist.com. SPITFIRELIST.com. There is a wealth of material. In fact, one could say it's the website that ate Cleveland. It reminded me of an old B-grade sci-fi movie that I used to enjoy. It's got tons of material. It's all free, by the way. They're just... thousands of pages of printed documentation, links to all kinds of sites and articles. The book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile is available for free. It's got a search function. Links, by the way, to a website put together by John Buchanan, a Republican maverick from New Hampshire, former Green Beret, by the way, who got declassified U.S. documents proving not only the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before and during World War II, but specifically linking Prescott Bush Sr., the grandfather of the current seated president, to the all-important Nazi flight capital program after World War II, supervised by the deadly Martin Bormann.
Now, it's interesting. We spent 2 hours earlier in the day with a man named John Buchanan, the same John Buchanan. So it is a small world.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. Well, he got those documents, and I actually have used his work in a number of broadcasts. And I hear so many people, Dr. Stan, I'm digressing again here, but I encourage them to get active, you know, and they say, well, I don't want to be a form of afraid. You know, I can understand fear. I mean, I've dealt with it myself. But a listener in the Midwest, my program is carried by a number of stations around the U.S., and including on the University of Michigan radio station. And there's a fellow there who's a high school teacher, and he shares the programs with his class. And they put together a website to engage in political discourse. They would put political cartoons on there. Anyway, they contacted John Buchanan, who very graciously sent them copies of all of his documents and wrote copyrighted introductions to each section. And they put these documents up on a website. So now the actual documents that John Buchanan, a genuine American hero like John Loftus, with whom he's worked, the documents that John Buchanan obtained are now available online. You can read the actual documents proving not only the Bush family's involvement with the Third Reich, but most importantly, in my opinion, Prescott Bush Sr.'s involvement with the Bormann Flight Capital Program. And my own feeling is that the Bush family is very much like Faust. They made a deal with the devil, and I think that they're bound on the wheel. My own impression of the current George Bush, whom I voted against and will vote against again, I think he's actually probably in his heart of hearts a pretty nice guy, but he's bound on the wheel. He's not a free agent. He is bound in one of the most insidious family traditions there is, and part of it is that they got their start in post-World War II business in part courtesy of this Nazi flight capital. Again, money that had been stolen from people murdered in Europe and was then shipped abroad, and Prescott Bush Sr. was involved with that, and thanks to John Buchanan and to these high school students in Michigan, people can now view that online, and there's a link on the Spitfire website to that.
And what is the name of that website?
It's Debate Comics, one word, one word composed of two, the word debate, D-E-B-A-T-E-C-O-M-I-C-S, one word, as so many internet domain names are, composed of two words, debatecomics.org, then a front slash, and then it's all one word, again, composed of three words, Bush Family Fortune, and the B in Bush and the two F's in Family Fortune are capitalized. And there's a front slash after that. Or you can just go to the Spitfire website and get the link and go by the link that's there. But the actual website, www.debatecomicsoneword.org, front slash, and then, again, one word composed of three, Bush Family Fortune, with the B in Bush and the F in both family and fortune being capitalized. So it's actually five words turned into two, as the internet so often does. www.debatecomics.org front slash Bush Family Fortune, all one word, but with the B in Bush and the F in family and fortune being capitalized. And due to the efforts of the heroic John Buchanan and a heroic group of high school students in Michigan, that's now available. See, I know so many people, Dr. Stanley, they're afraid to do it, and they're afraid of their shadows. Oh, you better not do it. You're going to get in trouble. You're going to get in trouble. I was in a restaurant with some friends celebrating my birthday, and we were talking about some of this, and our server came up to me, and she said, you know, you shouldn't talk like that. And I said, why not? She said, somebody might hear you. Which I thought, this is material that I talk about on the radio, which I thought that was pretty funny. But anyway, so that information is now available.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break here. And just remember that when the government fears the people, there's freedom. But when the people are fearful of the government and reprisal, why, of course, there will be tyranny. And ladies and gentlemen, we're heading towards the loss of our freedom. You've got to get involved. Help us get the truth out. Dave is committed to it. I'm committed to it. Are you committed to it? Are you willing to do nothing as they send our boys overseas, more of them, to die? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is one of my favorite guests, and I hope yours as well, and that of course is Dave Emery. We're talking about, well, right now we were just talking about how many people are fearful to take a stand. If I take a stand, why, they might come looking for me. Well, ladies and gentlemen, they're going to be looking for you anyway. And in fact, that old adage, if you don't stand up now on your two feet and say no, why, you may very well one day be on your knees saying yes. And of course, it's things like this that makes cowards out of a man. A coward dies 1,000 times. A brave man dies but once. And if you believe that there is a God in heaven, as I do, and even though Dave and I may disagree theologically, I think we both believe that there is a grand design for the universe, why I think that each one of us has a part to play. The courage question is, do you have the courage to take a stand in times like this and help us disseminate the information? And we're both working full-time to do exactly that. Well, pick up the story from there, Dave.
All righty. And by the way, motivated by religious faith at this point. Everybody dies. You know that. But the thing is that the more one studies things, the very few really serious scientists are atheists. You know, when people, physicists and others, when they begin examining the physical universe, they come to the conclusion that a consciousness produced this. You know, it's something a lot of people associate high science with atheism. That's not true at all. Einstein was deeply religious. Most of the really skilled scientists and highly accomplished scientists are, but the more they study the remarkable physical universe, the more they conclude that something made this, and it was a conscious act. But everybody dies someday, and I think it's important to understand that people have a portion of them, their soul, that is immortal. And as a result, I think they have to, when they see evil in the world, I think they have to be able to place themselves at risk in order to combat that evil. I believe, frankly, and again, I'm not a Christian, I don't belong to a Christian church, but I think the metaphor of Christ on the cross is a way that everyone must live. You know, you must, in the end, be ready to sacrifice your earthly life for the greater good, because there is something beyond that, and it's in the knowledge of that that I do what I do. So let's get back. Let's go back to Washington D.C. now, and we're going to go back to what happened on April 4th, 2002. Actually, the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination.
All right, fine. And, of course, we'll be back to that in just a moment here. And, of course, this all goes back as we began this program almost 2 hours ago, talking about this article in the Wall Street Journal on April 4th, 2002, announcing that there'd been a major break on a number of raids on people associated. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking this evening with Dave Emery, and of course we're talking about this raid that took place on April 4th, 2002, at least it was reported in the Wall Street Journal that day, and of course there was a network of Islamic organizations that were interlocked, and they were funding Hezbollah, Hamas, and of course Al-Qaeda, and the rest of this Islamic terrorist movement. Now, it had been known for many years that was here, but and everything had been dubbed to cover this up, and then a man named John Loftus had put together a very convincing dossier to the point where the Justice Department could not necessarily ignore it. So they, whether they wanted to or not, they were forced actually to raid and began, of course, to pick up all the various parts of this whole interlocked network right here in the United States, funding the very people who attacked the United States on the 11th of September of the previous year. Pick up the story from there, David.
Alrighty. Actually, the dates, the actual raids took place on March 20th of 2002. Article appeared in the Wall Street Journal, specifically on page A4 on April 18th, but the events, the thing that, and I guess it's kind of typical of my appearances on your show, Dr. Stan. We get involved in all these amazing things. It's, you know, when I'm on your show, it's kind of like jazz. You know, we do what are called riffing, what jazz musicians do. They kind of improvise because there's so many different avenues that we can travel along and be creative, so that it's a little bit like good jazz musicians improvising on stage. But what happened on April 4th, 2002 was that Talat Osman, a director of Harkin Energy, George Bush's energy company, who got there courtesy of the Saudis, and something that I've neglected to mention, Dr. Stan, something I'm sure you and Natalie know about, Talat Osman found his way into the Bush camp courtesy of the milieu of the BCCI. Now, have you spoken about that with your listeners in the past?
Not for some time. Why don't you go ahead? Some people call it the Bank of Congressmen and Criminals, but other people call it BCCI. The CIA was using this to funnel money and, of course, to launder a lot of the money they were getting from the drug activities. Certainly they were using it to fund money, I believe, into the hands of the Islamic terrorists. But you pick up the story.
It was the largest bank failure in history. It was a huge, huge bank, actually technically based in Pakistan, but much of the capital came from Saudi investors. And it was used for financing terrorism. It was used for laundering drug money. It was a major, major player in the international arms trade. Often one finds the drug trade and the arms trade inextricably linked. The BCCI was one of the major vehicles for financing the Afghan Mujahideen. It was one of the major vehicles that the elder George Bush used to help arm Saddam Hussein, because the elder George Bush was actually in charge. You know, during the Iran-Contra scandal, he claimed to be out of the loop. But actually, the arming of the Iranians, the shipping of weapons to the Contras, East Bloc weapon of the Contras, and the shipping of American arms to Saddam Hussein were accomplished through the same network, as was the arming of the Mujahideen. And the elder George Bush was in charge of that. I would say that probably the two most underrated men in history in terms of their influence, one was Martin Bormann. Most people even don't even know who he was. And I think probably the single most influential man in the second half of the 20th century, and the elder George Bush, who's one. I was talking to somebody who didn't think the elder George Bush was very important, and I asked him. I said, "Do you know who FBI headquarters is named for?" He said, "Isn't that named for J. Edgar Hoover?" It's quite true. I said, "Do you know who CIA headquarters is named for?" And he didn't. Well, it's named for the elder George Bush. Very powerful man. But the BCCI was a bank, but it was actually used to finance terrorism, launder drug money, ship weapons around.
Wasn't that the one that had Clark Clifford as one of the directors here in the United States?
He was. So was William Casey. And I believe the elder George Bush was a director, too. But, yes, it ultimately was able to purchase First America Bank shares and had a tremendous amount of money, and it, as such, a lot of very influential people were involved with it. Ultimately, it collapsed because it was a criminal operation. It was called by some the Bank of Crooks and Criminals International.
In fact, Clark Clifford was indicted and was to be tried for his involvement in this bank swindle, and Clark Clifford was just too dilapidated. He had all these letters from his doctors saying he was just too sick to stand trial, so they dropped the charges against him, and then they threw this gala party at his residence to celebrate the fact that dropped the charges. He had a miraculous recovery, and now he is still in the best of health. But, of course, they've never brought charges for his part in the collapse of this bank that was operating totally illegally here in the United States, laundering money. But when you belong to the Council on Foreign Relations, when you belong to the upper echelons of the people who really run America, why, you're above the law, as is Clark Clifford.
Absolutely. And actually, that brings us to what the Wall Street Journal of April 18th was talking about. April 4th of 2002, Talat Othman, again, a Palestinian-American, very successful businessman, a director of Harkin Energy, very influential political advisor to the elder George Bush, friend to both Georges Bush, political contributor to the campaigns of both Georges Bush, and a man who'd given a Muslim benediction to the Republican Convention, and somebody who was part of the BCCI environment. He interceded with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. Now, recall that the Operation Green Quest raid, that was the name for the task force, Operation Green Quest. The idea was to cut off the flow of money to the terrorists. And the Operation Green Quest raids were conducted primarily by customs agents, and at that time, Customs Department was part of the Treasury Department. It has since been moved to the Department of Homeland Security. But Talat Othman interceded with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill on behalf of the individuals and institutions who had been arrested in the United States of America for financing Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and even more importantly, Al-Qaeda. One slight correction, Dr. Stant. I don't believe they were involved with funding Hezbollah.
They were not, okay.
That's Shia, and most of their material, most of their support comes from Iran. There are areas of collaboration between the Hezbollah, the Shia terrorists, and the Sunni terrorists, but these were primarily Sunni. But in any event, the point is that when they arrested the institutions involved with financing them, it was in the United States, and then a close ally of George Bush's interceded with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. And observers in the Wall Street Journal article were amazed that he even could have gotten access. He said it's extraordinary to get access to an investigator when there's an ongoing investigation, let alone being able to sit down with the Secretary of the Treasury. Well, basically, Talat Othman said, nix. These guys are cool. Keep your hands off of them. They're fine. You know, there's nothing wrong. And Treasury Secretary O'Neill was fired a number of months later. And the Operation Green Quest is being frustrated. It turns out that the FBI is not cooperating with the Department of Homeland Security with regard to Operation Green Quest. And in fact, the actual name as an individual task force name has been eliminated. And Paul O'Neill was fired as Treasury Secretary. Customs Department has been folded into the Department of Homeland Security, one of whose top intelligence officials is a guy named Faisal Gill. He is a Muslim. He's a protege of Abdurrahman al-Amoudi, who's associated with Bank al-Taqwa, Al-Qaeda, and a lot of other institutions. And Faisal Gill has no experience in intelligence matters, yet he has a very high security clearance, and he's one of the top intelligence officials working with the Department of Homeland Security. But Operation Green Quest is now being covered up, and the people associated with the old Customs Department and with the Department of Homeland Security are basically saying the FBI is covering this up.
Well, you know, the most amazing thing is, Dave, that when the Joint Select Committee on Intelligence, they were the initial committee that was going to investigate the 911 debacle, well, they put out a report, and it was about 900 pages, but the Bush administration said, before you can put this report out and tell the American people what happened on 911, we want to censor this. And they went in and they took out 28 pages, just totally removed those pages that showed the Saudi funding of Al-Qaeda and of the attack on the United States. Now, why would they do something like that? And of course, the only logical explanation is they don't want the American people to know that the Bush administration is covering for the people who financed what happened on that morning.
Yes, and also people with whom they do business, because the Bushes have very strong business connections in Saudi Arabia. And again, many observers feel that the reason why the Saudis were so lavish in their financial support of the younger George Bush's oil companies was specifically to buy influence. They certainly didn't need the oil, because what would be a spectacular strike in South Texas would be essentially, or West Texas would be negligible for the Saudi oil field.
What, so, that old saying, politics is politics, but business is business.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And I did a whole series of programs. I was a little watching while the younger George Bush was running for president. I was just saying, well, you know, I did a whole series of shows that I called Trouble on Oiled Waters, all about what we were going to get into with the petroleum business. But it, the Operation Green Quest, by the way, which is being covered up, is being covered up by the FBI. And who is head of the FBI? My name is Robert Mueller. I guess he pronounces his name Mueller. I pronounce it Mueller, like the head of the Gestapo. Heinrich Mueller, who became the security director for the Bormann organization, literally a Third Reich gone underground. But you know what? One of the credits that Robert Mueller had, he was a U.S. attorney.
In fact, he was Janet Reno's appointee. So the Bush administration took one of Janet Reno's appointees to be assistant attorney general, or the prosecutor, I think, and they made him the head of the FBI. Why would the Bush administration take somebody that Janet Reno had so much confidence in?
Well, he actually he enjoyed the support of a number of people on both sides of the congressional aisle, but he actually had gotten his start as a U.S. attorney in the Bush Justice Department. But when he was appointed head of the FBI, he was U.S. attorney for Northern California, right up here in our neck of the woods, Dr. Stan.
Right.
And in that capacity had been, as you noted, was appointed by Janet Reno. But his political, resume goes back to the Bush had been the elder George Bush, because he'd been a prominent U.S. attorney. And the reason I think he was appointed, and this is, I should stress, very strongly my own opinion, was that he had been, shall we say, less than vigorous when he was a U.S. attorney. It was Robert Mueller who was in charge with the Justice Department, quote, investigation, unquote, of the BCCI. Because if you start going into those BCCI connections, you start coming across all of the nasty things that we're talking about here. You find that the Muslim Brotherhood, the Mujahideen, whom we were using against the Soviets, and I want to stress that I do not hold a brief for the Soviet system, but we were using these Islamic Nazis that had jumped to the CIA after the war against the Soviets, and that ultimately morphed into Al-Qaeda. So we're kind of dealing with our own Frankenstein's monster now. But Robert Mueller wrote the Justice Department report that basically whitewashed the BCCI. He also had been the Justice Department investigator, and that belongs in quotes, looking into the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, which also had strong connections to the Justice Department. And had that plane been able to land, there was a group of U.S. military intelligence agents under Major McKee, Major Charles McKee, that had come across the links in the Middle East, not only between the Contra support effort and drug dealers, but specifically they found that one of the principal people who had been supplying East Bloc arms for the Contras, who had also been shipping American arms to the Iranians and shipping American arms to Saddam Hussein, was a guy named Manzer al-Qassar, one of the world's leading arms traffickers, one of the world's leading drug dealers. The DEA estimated that he brings 20% of the heroin into the United States. He also was working as a double agent for Soviet military intelligence, but he was one of the main point elements for the Iran-Contra affair and was working with George Bush. Well, the McKee team was looking for the U.S. hostages being held in the Middle East, and while doing that, they, according to the Pan Am 103 insurance investigators report, came upon the links between the elder George Bush and elements of U.S. intelligence, and Manzer al-Qassar, drug dealer extraordinaire, terrorist extraordinaire. By the way, Manzer al-Qassar had put together the Achille Laurel hijacking, in which Leon Klinghoffer was thrown overboard by Palestinian terrorists, and they were on their way back to the U.S. to blow the whistle on this, but unfortunately they didn't get back to the U.S. because they died on Pan Am Flight 103. Well, Robert Mueller was the guy who wrote that report, and specifically I believe, and again, this is my own opinion, I believe that he was appointed head of the FBI, the nation's primary law enforcement agency, specifically because of all these old connections, you know, the connections of the elder George Bush to all of these drug dealers and arms traffickers and all these criminals that we were using for various purposes during the Cold War, the links to the BCCI, the links from the BCCI to the business environment of the younger George Bush. All of this was potentially too explosive, and I believe that Robert Mueller was put in place, and again, it's my personal opinion, to see to it that none of these connections ever unraveled. Well, sure enough, according to people with the Department of Homeland Security, many investigators, and by the way, reported by very conservative sources, some of the sources I've used for the my information about the subversion of Operation Green Quest, articles in the National Review and other publications. But apparently now, according to Homeland Security officials and others, that the FBI is actually covering up Operation Green Quest. And interestingly enough, one of the many things that would have been looked into in connection with Operation Green Quest was a company in Massachusetts called P-TECH. Have you spoken about this with your listeners?
No, I really am not acquainted with that one at all.
P-TECH's fascinating because it's a high-tech company that makes software. It's located outside of Boston. I'm not sure if it's in Brockton or one of the suburban towns outside of Boston. But anyway, it's a computer software company. But it turns out to be little more, at least in terms of its capitalization, it turns out to be very closely associated with Al-Qaeda, with people like Abdullah Azzam, with people that were associated with some of the targets of Operation Green Quest. Now, the interesting thing about this is because there are strong links between the milieu of Al-Qaeda, you know, the environment of Al-Qaeda, the environment of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and P-TECH. The Bank Al-Taqwa has strong links to the people around P-TECH. And there are strong areas of overlap between the individuals and institutions that were targeted by the March 20th Green Quest raids and P-TECH. Anyway, P-TECH manufactured threat assessment software for the U.S. Air Force and the Federal Aviation Administration, which I think is very, very interesting. Some of the curious performance or lack of performance by air defense units on September 11th may well be due to the fact that their threat assessment software was being manufactured by a company associated with Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood and the Bank Al-Taqwa. And it was actually when people who were members, who were employees of P-TECH, when they learned that some of the people who had helped to capitalize that company were on the terrorist finance watch list, they begged people in charge of the company to go to the FBI, but they didn't, so the employees went to the FBI. And interestingly, one person who was trying to get the heads of the people involved with P-TECH to go to the FBI was told, oh, don't worry, because Yaqub Mirza, who's the director of P-TECH, has very strong connections within the FBI.
Hold that. We're going to have to just take a quick break here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program. Dave, let's get your website out one more time, and then your parting thoughts for us this evening.
All righty. The website is Spitfire. Well, the company that, that's a one-man company that distributes all the material that I've done for free, by the way. I mean, they make money, I don't. But it's called Spitfire. Website, www.spitfirelist.com. There's tremendous amount of information there. There are thousands of pages of documentation, links to all kinds of articles, other websites. The book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning is available for download for free. Links to the website featuring the documents John Buchanan unearthed. And also links to two websites maintained by a radio station on the East Coast that has all of the work that I've done since 1995 available online on Real Audio for free. So if you live in a part of the country that can't listen to what I do, you can always listen to it online. It's all there, and it's all available, and it's all free. I do this out of patriotism and spiritual faith. I don't do it to make money, and I've been very good at not making money doing this. By the way, speaking of making money, I will be speaking in Santa Cruz, and hopefully I will make some money from that. That'll be Saturday night, 7 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Community Center. We're going to be talking about September 11th. We're going to be talking about the elections, and I'm going to make a few suggestions. But anyway, so that's where the website is, www.spitfirelist.com. It is a movable feast. There's as much information there as anybody could want.
And I'm sure I've been on the website. It's an excellent one. Well, we got just about a minute for you to wrap things up for this evening. It's been fascinating, of course, as always. So what thought would you like to leave with our listeners as far as the elections coming up? Is it really going to matter a lot whether it's Tweedledum or Tweedledee, Republican Party A, Democrat Party B?
My own feeling is, yeah, I think there are some significant differences. I have more questions than answers about Kerry and his position with Skull and Bones. It may be that simply the Bonesmen are telling him there's some things you can't talk about. For example, the kinds of things I've been talking about on this program. You know, if I wanted to blow George Bush out of the water, I would simply go to Peoria, Illinois, or to Main Street, USA, say, hey, did you realize that a close political ally of George Bush's, a good friend of his, a business partner, interceded successfully with the Treasury Secretary on behalf of individuals and institutions that were busted for funding Al-Qaeda?
Well, I think anybody who's looked into this knows that certainly the Bush family is close to the Saudis, and the Saudis were very close to the terrorists. Hey, we're out of time, Dave. We'll look forward to having you on again, and I hope you get a great turnout this coming Saturday at the Loudon Nelson Center.
Well, what can I say, Dr. Stan? Appearing on your show is, for me, it's always like the research equivalent of Thanksgiving. There's more there than I could possibly consume, but it's always a pleasure.
Good night. God bless you.
Okie doke. Thanks so much.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and I hope you've enjoyed our program with Dave Emery. If you'd like to get, of course, the entire text, it will be on the Internet, and you can pull it down from then, or, of course, you can order the tapes from Radio Liberty by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then we do hope that many of you out there in the listening audience will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and joining in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation founded under God on Christian principles can long exist. Because at one time, everybody in the world knew America was a Christian nation. Today, there's very little evidence of that still. So our job is to get people to understand what's going on and to encourage them to join us in this epic struggle. And then, of course, we do hope you'll go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. America is under attack today. They're poisoning the minds of our children with the mercury drugs, thimerosal they put in the vaccines. Well, they've taken it out of the childhood vaccines, but they're still putting it into the vaccines, the influenza vaccine. According to Dr. Fudenberg, Fudenberg, if you are over 60 years old and you take three or four influenza shots within a five-year period, your chance of getting Alzheimer's disease goes up 1,000%. Let me repeat that. If you're over 60 and you take three or four influenza shots, one a year for 3 or 4 years, your chance of getting Alzheimer's disease goes up 1,000%. So why are they pushing the toxic influenza vaccine when usually it doesn't do much of any good because it's for the wrong type of virus, wrong influenza virus? Why America is under attack today. For the same reason, they're poisoning our children with aspartame, or they're poisoning our children with MSG, or they're poisoning our children with fluoride, or they're poisoning our children's minds and decreasing their mental capacity with mercury. They know exactly what we're doing because we're involved in a battle with truly evil people. So we hope that you'll want to get the information. You can get our 4-tape set on fluoride, on mercury, our 4-tape set on aspartame, our 4-tape set on why do we still have cancer. And the question every one of you should ask is, how many people do you know are dying of cancer today? Why do we have so much cancer today when we didn't have this much cancer 50 years ago? Why we had a war on cancer, and when we have a war on cancer, we get more cancer. We have a war on drugs, we get more drugs. We have a war on poverty, we get more poverty. We have a war on terrorism, and why we seem to be getting more and more terrorism throughout the world. Could this be just a coincidence? I would like to suggest there are people who are intent upon destroying this country, And we are sworn, I know when I have run for political office, I've sworn to defend this country from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And believe me, there are domestic enemies here. So you need to get the information. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can listen to our program directly or indirectly 5 hours a day on the Internet, 4 hours a day on shortwave. And we do hope that many of you will get the materials we have and that you will help us as we reach out across America. We have just gotten onto another new satellite, so this program, evening program, is on 3 satellites. Now we picked up 2, maybe even 3 new stations in this last month. As the coverage gradually increases across America and people, of course, are getting the information they're not going to get elsewhere, well, this is the time, of course, we I want to mention our November 6th meeting. It's going to be on the North Shore of Monterey Bay, Aptos Seascape Golf Course, all-day long session. Saturday, November 6th, we're bringing in outside speakers. There'll be lunch. It should be a great time. It has been the last 3 or 4 years we've had the program. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders, our ministers. Pray for revival, because we truly are involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And lastly, please pray for Radio Liberty. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.